Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, Donald Trump was on Fox News today, and more cavalcade of crazy. Evidently, he said, you know, the virus is going to go away. It's going to go away all by itself. It does that. Things go away. It'll go away like things go away. It'll go away. Don't worry about it. It's good. And look, we're in really good shape. The U.S. is in very good shape. It's going to be fine. Never mind the fact that, we're having, what is it, tens of thousands of new cases every day. Yesterday was a record day of deaths, 1,380. But hey, sunny optimism. I guess when he said, shove the sunshine up your behind, I guess that's more literal for him than figurative. But he did talk about reopening the schools as well and said, look, children are almost immune. They're almost immune to it. But those old teachers should probably stay home. That is our president. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on, kids are almost immune, man. It's not a big deal. Not a big deal. I've asked our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck, to come share some thoughts on, maybe he knows better than I do. Maybe kids are immune. Dr. Pocheck, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me. I enjoyed your intro. It drummed up some, Upton Sinclair, the Jungle. For me, which is like such a formative book for me, but anyway, I appreciate that. It was great to hear.
No, it's really kind of the rhetoric that comes, and look, people buy this, that it'll just go away. Yeah, it'll go away when there's nowhere else for it to go.
Yeah, well, that's true. When you look at the numbers, are children a little, are they less likely to suffer severe complications? Yeah, they are. But, what we have to realize is that, they are also amazing vectors for disease. You try to, teach a three-year-old to wear a mask, in a social setting with hundreds of other people, and it's just not going to happen.
So, nope.
And you can't, you can't blame the kiddo for that. It's just, you have to have an understanding of microbiology to be able to realize why you have to wear a mask and why you have to social distance and why you have to, keep your hands out of your face and wash your hands. And, you can't expect that population to necessarily understand it. So, of course, when we go back to school, are we going to see a huge bump in cases? Absolutely, we are.
Yeah,
we are.
I mean, here's the thing. We're expecting a three-year-old to get it when you look at the 50-year-old Karens running around screaming that, I've got a card!
Well, exactly, yeah. And, it's another situation where, obviously, healthcare workers have borne the brunt of a lot of bad policy, and we've, had to deal with, huge numbers, huge demand, angry people, understandably. But the same could be said of transportation workers, of restaurant. I mean, look at restaurant workers, making $2 and change an hour and depending on tips and having people sit around, tables with no masks on, coughing and laughing. And I mean, they can just get decimated. These staffs can just get decimated by this and have no livelihood because of it. And the fact that you just realize that workers are truly being treated as nothing more than a business expense.
That's always been what it is, Keith. I mean, workers have always been a negative on a balance sheet. As benevolent as any company's ever going to be, at the end of the day, the boss's kid is going to eat before your kid eats any day of the week, and there's never been a question, and there never will be a question about that.
Well, but I think I don't know. I mean, I think that's a little pessimistic. I mean, I just think it depends on who's in power and who's looking out for the little people. I mean, I think that there's always this pendulum that swings between capital and labor, and there have been times when we really needed it. When you look at the New Deal and you look at recoveries that America's had in the past, and it's been you know, governments and administrations who've looked out for regular Americans and have looked out for workers. And so, I mean, I think that we can rekindle that if we, you know, if we're able to elect the right people.
Right.
I really do.
Yeah, but that comes back to government policy. My point is, at the end of the day, the capital class is always going to line their pockets first. And no matter how much PR and how much spin that they put into it, it's them first. And well, you're an afterthought. And I point to the fact that, and I'm sure you remember, like everybody else, all the talk of all the frontline heroes and the essential workers and how they were going to give, you know, like an extra dollar here or $2 there or a bonus. And boy, there was PR everywhere. There were press releases and stories, but all that stuff's being clawed back. And now we're seeing, not just are they clawing it back, they're taking more and more away and heaping more and more work on it. And I look at, you know, the medical profession. You know, these nurses, as you've pointed out, they're overworked, understaffed, and it's only getting worse while the insurance companies are lining their pocket with massive profits.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, what one of the things people don't realize is that there really is a form of, especially for hospital workers, you know, who are in the ER or who are in the ICUs and things like that, There truly is a form of PTSD that these folks deal with, and it's not so much that they're worried that you know, that they're going to die at work. You know, I mean, it's not the same as a soldier who's under fire, but you have this constant worry that one of the people who you're charged with caring for is going down the tubes, and you can't get to them, you can't fix it. I mean, these are like the anxiety dreams of healthcare workers who work in the acute setting, just because you're not supported enough. You know, that's what drives, actually, to be honest with you. I mean, I have conversations like this all the time with folks who leave the emergency department, whether they're nurses, whether they're physicians, or whether they're, you know, physician assistants or nurse practitioners. Same theme over and over and over. You know, I just felt like I couldn't, you know, do the job that I wanted to be able to do and put my name on, and I was worried that, you know, things were going south and I couldn't recognize it, and there were so many demands placed on me that I was just overall felt like I was doing a poor job with all of them because there were so many demands. Yeah. And that's the situation, I think. And you know, you could say this about a lot of workers. I think that you know, education workers and teachers are in a very similar predicament. You know, you could say this about many, many other workers.
I think you're right. I think you're healthcare workers especially, though, because you guys see, you know, the stuff that none of us do. You know, you watch the TV shows on ER and you go, oh, that's a little, you know, you're seeing the unvarnished ER, not that the stuff they show us on TV. You're seeing the real misery, the real pain and the suffering. And then here's where I struggle and where it would infuriate me. If I'm one of the nurses or I'm a doctor like you are, and I see someone who, you know, should be vibrant and healthy, and this disease is just, you know, this virus is just eating down to nothing, and I walk outside and I see a bunch of people not wearing masks and, you know, basically in the most ignorant of ways going about, screw you, I'm not doing it, it's my right, I would lose my ever-loving freaking mind.
And we just don't, and that drives home a good point, is that we don't connect, we don't communicate with each other who are, you know, working different jobs, seeing different things. And, you know, so few of us, I think, in America have, you know, have come across someone who's been really sick or has been in the ICU or has died of COVID, that it's still, to a lot of people, it's just like this boogeyman in the closet that they're not even really sure if it exists or not. And this, and then you throw in quarantine and the fact that we're compartmentaling ourselves. I didn't quite say enough syllables. Anyway,
I'm with you too. It's a tough word.
Yeah,
compartmentalizing.
Anyway, yeah, we're dividing ourselves. Sorry.
There you go. That's better.
Into so many categories and not connecting across those categories that, you know, we don't even really understand how real this is for some people. And you know, instead we're just getting our info from media outlets, and you know, for the right wing folks, for you know, Fox News and God knows whatever,
what other crazy right wing outlets?
Else.
Alex Jones.
Yeah.
Jones, who's telling people to defensively kill people at protests.
But yeah, exactly. You know, and we just we are unbelievably divided. And then you take something like this, and it's divided us even more. It's also unmasked some of the inequalities in America. I mean, you look at, my wife and I were talking about who had a choice to send their kids back. You know, people have a choice to send their kids back to school, and that's a really tough choice on what you're going to do either way. You know, I mean, you could sacrifice your kid's social development, or you could, you potentially risk them getting infected with COVID. And what's neglected in that discussion is that there are a lot of people who don't have any choice whatsoever. You know, I mean, they've got to go back to work. They've got to keep the lights on. They've got to pay the bills. They've got to, and you know, like any social, event, any natural disaster, any major illness or pandemic, it's always disproportionately going to affect the people who are poor and disadvantaged, and this is going to just unmask that even more. You know, I mean, it's just going to undo, I think, so much of what we have accomplished probably over the last 30, 40 years in moving towards equality. And that's just, I mean, that's just how much harder we're going to have to work. And
I'm with you. But here's the thing, and you had said a moment ago that you think healthcare workers suffer from a form of PTSD, and I absolutely agree. And in fact, I got a response from someone on Twitter who said, as a veteran, he believes that, all of the essential workers, not just healthcare workers, should get the same kind of benefits that veterans coming back from war are getting, because, this is an invisible enemy. And this is, a breeding ground for PTSD in his view.
It is. I mean, I think it's definitely going to shorten a lot of people's careers. Hopefully not mine. I mean, we have an incredible team. We're working in the outpatient scenario. We're working in urgent care, and we're doing tons and tons of COVID evaluations and testing, and we've done so many things to try to keep our team safe and do a lot of these evaluations for minimally sick patients out there at the curbside, and it's worked very well. But how is that going to merge into flu season? This fall, are we still going to plan on keeping everyone outdoors? And I mean, it's just there's so many questions here that that arise, and ultimately we just thank God we've got a team that's we've really rallied pretty well here in what we're doing in North Carolina, and we've done an incredible amount of testing, and we've diagnosed a few thousand cases on our team here, and we've remained, knock on wood, incredibly well.
Good for you.
And so I mean, there's some hope. I mean, I think that's where it all starts. It's just with these little connections and these teams that are maybe tens or dozens of people, and that's how we move it forward. And we just keep on kind of pressing, and we look towards other areas of the country and other areas of the world and say, hey, look, they hit their peak, and eventually they hit their the downslide, and things seem to normalize somewhat, and hope to God we get there.
Let me ask you this, because one of the concerns I get from a lot of people who are in the medical profession is there is this, we're at war kind of mentality that's going on right now, and no one wants to leave at this moment while their coworkers or while their system is under siege, if you will. When this does recede, and it will at some point, do you fear that, like a lot of people do, that people are just going to go, I'm done, I'm out, and we don't get people into the healthcare field, and we end up worse off than when we started?
I think that's a real concern. I really do. I do think that we're going to see attrition. I think we probably already are. We have times where, to get shifts filled and things like that, we have to offer some extra pay and other sorts of incentives and already. But luckily we've been able to keep all of our sites open and are doing what we can to protect our team. But, I do. I think, one of the things I think that is going to be a barometer, or I guess kind of a bellwether for that, is that just the number of medical school applications that you see every year. And so that's something I think we've got to keep our eye on. But at the end of the day, still, it's going to be when these folks do finish residency and come out, where are they going to go? Is everyone going into a subspecialty? Are there people who are doing primary care in, intensely urban and underserved rural areas or not? How do we incentivize that? I really, really worry that healthcare disparities and inequalities are just going to widen because of something like this.
Yeah. No. And the thing is, you know, as people continue to lose jobs and or don't find new ones, the number of uninsured continue to go up, and it will be even more taxing on our system. Because look, the reality is as you know, we're taking care of the virus, and that's been the focus of our healthcare system. All of the other things that you know we would go to the hospital for or need medical services for are being kind of put on hold. And as someone pointed out to me,
absolutely,
you know, had you not had your hip done when you did, Rick, you'd be still waiting. And I go, yeah, but I wouldn't be dead.
Yeah,
and
right.
I'd be happy to wait, but I would get to it eventually. Well, there's a lot of people out there like that now where eventually they're going to get to it, and then there's going to be a slam on our system of people at a time when I fear people are going to be leaving.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that if everything's presenting later in the stage, just think about you and your hip. If you had to wait a few more months and it affected your function and your mobility that much more and you were that much more deconditioned when you had your procedure done, how much longer and how much more painful would your recovery have been?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. I would have lived.
And you would have lived, but that could have really drawn things out, and that could have put you at risk for some more complications. And I think that we see more and more and more patients who are presenting later in the stages of their disease,
right,
because they're too concerned to come to the hospital. And hospitals, at least where I am, have done an amazing job of being able to cohort patients and sequester folks based on whether they're potentially COVID worrisome or not. And that's been incredible, but I don't think that necessarily the public understands that. They think, oh dear God, I can't go to the hospital now. I can't go to the ER.
So, in your view, is it's perfectly okay to go to the hospital then? Hang around the ER. Is that what I'm hearing from you?
I mean, I would say that you never want to go there if you don't have to. But I think that the screening, at least where I am, is impressive as far as how they can keep upright folks who are, potential COVID patients upright and outside and out of the ED versus, folks who are clearly not worrisome for that, and universal masking and things like that as far as when they bring people back. It's been impressive to see. Think that they've done a great job with it so far.
Yeah, but on my point with the hip, I waited 10 years. From the time they told me you should do it to the time I actually did it, another couple of months probably wouldn't have killed me.
maybe not.
Just throwing that out there as an aside. My wife, on the other hand, you never know. But me, I think I'd have gotten through it. I wanted to get your thoughts on this as well, though, because as you said, you're doing a great job of picking this stuff out. But there was an AP report today that's saying that the amount of testing is dropping. Even as simultaneously we see a rise in cases and a rise of daily death numbers, that the for a plethora of reasons, one being that the tests take so damn long to get, they're almost, what's the point? I'm curious your thoughts.
We've done, and this is interesting you bring this up, because I just a few days ago compared our data in our county, in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina, to national data. And so we have about a 1% mortality rate as far as diagnosed cases and mortality. The rest of the country is at around 3%. And so, my wife and I were talking, and I said, so either we're dramatically underestimating the number of deaths that we have related to COVID, which I don't think that's accurate.
Or you're testing a lot of people.
Or we're testing a lot of people and diagnosing a lot of asymptomatic and minimally symptomatic cases. And I clearly think it's that, especially where I sit, and I see the number of tests that we do every day. So, if there's any cause for optimism, it's that I honestly think that our mortality rate here in our county is probably closer to the true disease mortality rate, because I know how available testing is here. Why is that exactly? I mean, I think our state's done well, our county health departments have done well, but we also have two big competing healthcare systems that you know, to be honest, they want the business, and so they want to test people. And the tests are pretty widely available here. And so if there's cause for optimism, I think that, you know, take a peek at Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. It's not because I'm here.
No. Look, you know, the thing is, thank goodness. I mean, there's somewhere doing it right, because, you know, what I see across this country is a major failure of leadership, especially in the quote unquote red states, where they're still, you know, not sure what they want to do because, well, they still want to call it a hoax. And, you know, I just had this conversation the other day. You know, someone said that it's only 1%, 1% death rate. And I go, yeah, that's still over 3 million people.
Right. Absolutely. And that's the debate you have with about sending your kids back to school. Yeah, sure, the math works out in your favor until it's your kid, and then all of a sudden it doesn't. And so, it's going to be a leap of faith for some people. It's going to be for some people. They're not going to have a choice. They're just going to have to go with it. And those are going to be the folks who are more likely to be, you know, disadvantaged and poor. Obviously, I mean, that's every single crisis that's ever faced America and America or the world in the history of the world. But is there any cause for optimism yet? I don't know. I mean, I think that we have to wait and see what the next month brings.
Right.
You know, when we honestly see widespread, hey, let's go back to school.
But
here's the numbers show.
Here's my problem, though, Keith. You know, there's been so much fudge in the numbers, to use a George W. Bush frame. There's been so much potential where I don't know that I trust any number that comes out anymore, because there's been so many shenanigans done. You've got an administration that is hell-bent on moving, pretending it doesn't exist, saying, oh, it's just going to disappear. We got to move forward. And you've got a political system that's set up on, one party saying, you know, we're not going to do anything for it. And the other party saying, you know, we've got to lock down. And I think the average person is their head spinning with misinformation, disinformation,
right,
too much information, no information. I mean, it's overload.
It is. I agree with you. I mean, I think that it's really fallen on local leadership at this point. And, you could wind up in the wrong county, the wrong state, and, you have no idea what's happening. That's just because there's an utter vacuum at the top. And we all know that.
So you don't agree with Republican Alabama senatorial candidate Tommy Tuberville when he says that we should just let Donald Trump do everything, send the Democrats home. He said, we probably get more done with just the president running the country. So let the Democrats go home and do whatever they do, which is not govern, which is not to try and help the American people. And President Trump can get it done. He'll get it done.
What a good little fascist he is, right? What a good little fascist. And isn't it incredible that, I mean, like, this is a guy that coached, a football team of probably 80% African American players for I don't know how many years in Alabama, and this was the like unabashed fascist sort of ideology that he had throughout the course of that. Is that incredible?
No, it's not incredible. It's who these football coaches always were. I mean, there's no shock in this to me. This is a guy who made, for years, $2 million plus salaries a year off of exploiting poor kids. So, look, I've got no delusions that this is a decent guy.
But how can you get those players to rally behind you with that mentality? I mean, are you able to lie that convincingly to people's faces to get them to kind of like follow you and rally behind you? I mean, that's what blows my mind more than anything. I just feel like maybe, if it were me trying to lie in front of that many people, that everyone would see right through me, and maybe they're just that talented at it.
Or they're just, that's just how they are. I mean, at the end of the day, you go play football at Auburn and you do well, you might have a chance of, cashing in.
Yeah, and maybe that's what he said in living rooms and whatnot of the parents of these kids, and who knows. It's unbelievable. I mean, the percentage of people who have no concept of American founding ideals and what we fought against to establish the country to begin with, just inconceivable. Like I think I tweeted this maybe a few days ago, where it's like, I'm really shocked at how 5 years ago, I had no idea how many closet fascists there were in America. When I look back at myself 5 years ago.
Yeah, right? No, you're absolutely right. You know, you just want the trains to run on time.
Yeah, exactly. That's all it was after, I guess. I don't know. You know, maybe that's me being naive and eternally optimistic that everyone sort of understood civics and American history the way that I did. And clearly they did not. We have different ideas of, you know, how all this started.
How do you think this started? How do you think I started this? You know, 15 years ago this Labor Day, I started this program because my Teamster buddies, people I worked with every day, had a very different view of the world than I did. And I'm still trying to figure out how it is that, you know, look, it started over really one thing. I had a union guy tell me we'd make more money if the union wasn't here. And yeah. I said, you know, show me where in this country where that's true. Where you'd get better pension, better health care, better wages. Show me where that's happening. And then I would ask you why you aren't there.
Right.
And, you know, again, but it's been, you know, they've been fed so much over misinformation, you know, so much pandering. It's terrible. And this is where it's gotten us. But again, you know, like I said, you got a football coach, you got coaching a freaking game, making $2 million a year when the nurse who's caring for someone who's, you know, making maybe $70,000 a year and being begrudged of that.
I saw a map where it was the highest paid state employee. You've probably seen it.
Yeah, it's all football coaches.
State employee, yeah, where it was, you know, pretty much everywhere south of, you know, Pennsylvania was a high school football or basketball coach. In North Carolina, it was a basketball coach because it was probably Roy Williams,
yeah,
at UNC. But that was the highest, you know, the highest state paid employee was a football or basketball coach.
Yeah, well, when they make twice the wage of the union, the university president, there's kind of a problem with the system.
Yeah.
Just a thought. But anyway, Keith, I appreciate the time. It's always good talking with you. I hope things turn. I hope Trump's right. I hope it goes away just all by itself. But I know it's not going to.
No, it's not yet. But I mean, hey, we can, you know, we're 4 months in right now and we're, you know, we still got our fist up and fighting. And so, I mean, that's a testament to the team of folks that we have down here. So I'm proud of them. And I think we're, you know, we're going to weather the storm.
Good stuff. Keith, I appreciate the insight, man. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick. Have a good night.
You as well. As always, our good friend, Dr. Keith Pocheck. I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.